Good morning. Is that on? Okay, great. How about that opening session? Many sheroes all in one room. I love it. My name is Jane Gazdaska, and I'm very excited to be here this morning. This will be my third Texas Women's Conference. I represent Phillips 66, who I am shouting out to all of the women in these front rows from Phillips 66, and also to our own Sonia Reed, who is up on the panel this morning. I am the general manager of U.S. product supply and distribution, and that is a very fancy way for saying that my group figures out the most effective and profitable way to move gasoline, distillate, and jet fuel around the country off of our 11 refineries in the United States. My company provides energy and they improve lives, and I am very proud to work there. And as I was thinking about today's topic, how we decide, I was thinking about the many decisions that get made in my current role. I work in a commodity trading room. Is anybody familiar with what that looks like, what that feels like? Anybody? Very fast-paced environment. A lot of people crammed in one room, very similar to this room, actually. But what's interesting about that is we deal with market dynamics and very fluid market dynamics, and things change very quickly. And because they change very quickly, we tend to make decisions that are contemplated around how we create the most options so that if plan A doesn't work because the market has changed, we pull the trigger on plan B and sometimes plan C. We really hate to go to plan D because we still want to make money. So it's it creates the most options for the short-term execution. And I think that in this case, I tend to look at it as the fact that we prioritize something called optionality in the decision-making process. But a lot of decisions aren't quite that straightforward. Some are associated with the short term, and some really are risky, they're costly, and they really deal with shifting people towards a long-term strategy. They have ripple effects with unintended consequences, and they require a bit more deliberation. And that's what the panel discussion is about this morning. They're going to cover why some decisions are so challenging and what these influential women have done to uncover a clear path forward for themselves and their companies. Today, Trudy, Sonia, and Anne will share their stories about how they've clarified priorities in their decision-making process and what types of support networks were most beneficial to them in that process. They're going to provide us with some insight into their personal decision making and share what's worked for them and what hasn't. And what better person than to facilitate that panel than the person that wrote the book on it? That would be Therese Houston. She literally wrote the book on how women make decisions. She holds a PhD in cognitive psychology, and she's currently a cognitive scientist at Seattle University. I'm not quite sure I'm smart enough to understand what a cognitive psychologist does, but I know Therese is going to enlighten us here in a minute. Her latest book, which will be available for signing after this session, is called How We Decide. The New York Times calls it required reading on Wall Street. And she's looking to change how we collectively see women as decision makers. She's written for the New York Times, the LA Times, the Harvard Business Review, and the Guardian, and her work has been featured on NPR. I love the fact that Oprah's magazine listed How Women Decide in their 21 books for your summer reading list this past year. Forbes recently did an interview with Therese, and 2 weeks ago, she did her first TED Talk. Yeah, Therese is rocking it, let me tell you. Her first book was called Teaching What You Don't Know, and she actually won the Book of the Year Award in Education from Forward Literary Reviews. Therese received her BA from Carleton College and a BS and a PhD in cognitive psychology from Carnegie Mellon University. She also did a prestigious postdoctoral fellowship with the Center for the Neural Basis of Cognition at the University of Pittsburgh. She founded the Center for Excellence in Teaching at Seattle University, Teaching and Learning, excuse me, and when she's not writing. She loves to travel, play with numbers, spend time with her husband and dog, and I hear she bakes an amazing gluten-free chocolate cake. Let's welcome Therese and the rest of the panel.
Thanks, Jane. That was so nice. Thank you. Good morning. It's great to be here. We are going to talk about the pressures that women feel as decision makers, and I'm going to bring to you two important observations from the research, and then I'm going to end my time with a valuable strategy for great decision makers, and then we're going to turn to the incredible women on this stage to hear about the decisions they've made. We're talking about decisions, and we want to think about the doors that we go through and the doors that we pass up, because all of us in this room face challenging decisions every day and some big decisions every once in a while. But before we get to those important observations about gender and decision making, I want you to reflect for a moment. So get out a piece of paper, or if you prefer, you can use your smartphone or a tablet, but I'm going to have you reflect for just a moment. And here's what I want you to write down. I'm going to give you 30 seconds. I even have my watch. So 30 seconds. And what I want you to write down, everyone you've taken care of in the past month. I'm serious. It's not big enough. So 30 seconds, go. All right, that's 30 seconds. So like we would say in class, put down your pens. all right, so can I get a show of hands? How many people wrote down at least 5 names? Okay. Do we have 10 names in that amount of time? Fewer? We at least 7 names? Counting your list, at least 7. Okay, so at least 5. Everybody seems to have at least 5 names. How many people, show of hands, how many people listed someone at work that you took care of? Okay. How many people listed someone at home that you took care of? Even more. How many people listed themselves? Good job! I have done that activity in locations where nobody has listed themselves. They've listed their neighbor's dog, but not themselves. I'm not saying that if you listed yourself, that's a bad decision. That's a good decision. And if you listed lots of other people and didn't list yourself, that could be an excellent decision as well. It could be this is a time when you really need to take care of people. The thing I want to underline here is that women are typically expected in society to be taking care of others, that is a prime expectation of how women will make decisions. So let's take a look at what the implications for that are. This is probably a familiar face, yes? Okay. Marissa Meyer, still the CEO of Yahoo. It is a daily thing to check, though. It really is. Would you rather I use this mic? Does it matter? Can everybody hear me okay? Okay, great. So, Marissa Meyer of Yahoo. So, many of you, should I get in show of hands, how many of you know that she made the decision to end Yahoo's work from home policy years ago? Yes, this was in 2013. If you didn't hear about it at the time, chances are you've heard about it since, because she received incredible criticism for ending Yahoo's work from home policy. So she made that decision because, at least the explanation she gave at the time, was she wanted to make sure that people could work more closely together at Yahoo. It affected about, I think the estimate is about 400 employees. And she was lambasted in the press. In 2013, Forbes had stories. In 2014, Time, again, had stories. And then in 2015, Richard Branson had an interview where he talked about how terrible this decision was on Marissa Meyer's part. And I don't know about you, but I also raised an eyebrow, like, getting rid of their work-from-home policy, this is terrible. All right. How many of you would be shocked to learn that approximately 1 week after Marissa Meyer made this decision that we all know about, Herbert Joly, the CEO of Best Buy, made the same decision. Actually affected 20 times more employees, affected over 5,000 employees, so it affected more people. But why haven't you heard about it? right? Business reporters dutifully reported it, especially in Minnesota, where Best Buy is headquartered, but it didn't make the news in 2014 and in 2015 and continue to make the news as a reason that Herbert showed Jolie should be ousted, right? So when we think about this, there are many possible reasons why Marissa Mayer went under fire. They, by the way, they had both been CEOs for 6 months when they each made this decision, so it wasn't that Marissa Mayer was newer at her job. It's remarkable the number of parallels, but we still haven't heard about this decision at Best Buy. Now, many reasons for that, but I think one of them is because it's expected that Marissa Mayer would take care of more working moms, that she would be looking out for four people, and Herbert Jolie is just responsible for making whatever might be the best decision for Best Buy. Of course, Mayer also has to make decisions about what's the best decision for Yahoo, but she has an added burden. So this is the first observation. The expectation in terms of how women will make decisions is that women will take care, but that men will take charge, right? So that would be the first observation I want you to take away. That's a common expectation. By the way, this is a finding. This was the consensus around a survey of 300 executives from around the world in terms of how they described women versus men's leadership. 34% of these were CEOs that were saying this. So this isn't just how we as employees view it, but also top-level executives view this is the difference in leadership style. So this is an expectation of how people are going to make decisions differently. So that's the first observation. The second observation is this. You want to know how to predict how intelligent a group is going to be? The way you predict how intelligent a group is going to be is count the number of women. Fascinating research has been done now. The lead team on this was Anita Williams-Woolley at Carnegie Mellon University and Thomas Malone at MIT. There were other people who've done similar studies, but they looked at the intelligence of groups, and they were trying to predict how can you guess how intelligent a group it's going to be. You might think that it's the IQ of the smartest member. Nope. You might think it's the average IQ of all the members. Nope. Tends to be the proportion of women in the group. So why is this? What kind of problems did they look at? It was really pretty clever studies. They brought together total strangers, put them in a room together for several hours, and gave them challenging problems. Like they said, here's a brick. Come up with as many creative uses for a brick as you can, right? And then they got points for each novel idea. Or they were given a problem where they were given limited resources and limited time, and they had to figure out how they were going to budget all the different resources to meet all the different people's needs in a way that best represented the priorities at the moment. Does that make sense? So not just dividing it three ways if there's three people, but how do we best capitalize on the priorities of the group? And what they found was that the problem solving went up as the proportion of women went up. And it wasn't that solo women were smarter than solo men. It's that groups with more women had more social sensitivity. Social sensitivity is a fancy psychology term for reading other people successfully. So one way to interpret this is reading nonverbal behavior. And the groups that had more women did that more successfully. When they were talking about the brick, they noticed if someone in the group looked like they had a new idea, and they brought that person into the conversation. If someone in the group looked skeptical when they were talking about budget divisions, they brought that person into the conversation. So it wasn't necessarily that the women talked more, it's that they made sure that the insights of everyone in the group were recognized. So kind of interesting how it fits with the taking care thing, right? An interesting approach to decision making. But the encouraging note I want you to take from this is if you want to build the intelligence of a team, add some more women. Mm-hmm. Now you might be thinking, all right, does this mean that women are naturally more gifted at reading nonverbal behaviors? No, actually the research shows that men can read nonverbal behaviors just as well as women. They just need to be motivated, all right? But when you bring a group together and they have to make an important decision, who tends to think that their success is going to rely on noticing other people's reactions? It tends to be the women. So I've given you two important observations. One, the common perception is that women are going to take care and men are going to take charge. And that's a reality we have to deal with as decision makers. The second important observation is that groups with more women tend to come to more insightful and better decisions. So if you needed a reason to bring more women into a group, you've now got one. Now let me end my part with one strategy, and then we're going to hear the strategies from the people on the stage here. So what does the research indicate is a very valuable decision-making strategy? When most of us are trying to make a decision, and this is, metaphorical with the doors, but you're trying to decide which door to go through. What do most people do? They don't look around at how many doors are there? Six different doors. They look at one door, right? Most of us, are when we try to make important decisions, are saying yes or no. Should I take this new job or not? Should we move or not? Should we get a new dog or not, right? Should we expand this division or not? And Paul Nutt, who's a business professor at Ohio State University, has found that when groups only consider one option and only are thinking about yes or no, long term, they decide that they've failed more than 50% of the time. So when you've only got one option, you're more likely to have, you're more likely to fail than to succeed. You're more likely to have more regrets. And what Nutt has found is that when people actually give themselves more options, they're more likely to come be happy with the decision later and have fewer regrets. So what does that mean? Instead of just thinking, should I leave my job or not? Should I go part-time or not? Should I take an exercise class at lunch? Maybe that would improve the quality of your day at work, right? But to generate more options, and that might help you truly identify what needs to be done. Does that make sense? All right, so I just want you to know, generate more. As soon as you go to two options, decision-making becomes better, becomes even better at three. It doesn't become easier, but it becomes better. All right, now I want to introduce my amazing colleagues up here. First we have, actually the order here does not reflect the way that we've ordered them on stage. So the person, sorry about that, closest to me is Trudy Bourgeois. She's the president and CEO of the Center for Workforce Excellence. Next to her is Ann Arvia. She is the vice president of banking services at USAA Federal Savings Bank. And then on the far end, we have Sonia Reed, who is at Phillips 66, where she is a senior vice president for human resources. So let's give a hand to them. And what we're going to turn to now is I'm going to be asking them questions. It seems a little odd for me to stay up here, but I am going to stay up here just to kind of bring in the whole room. If I sit down, I'll basically be invisible. So I want to make sure, I know this is a great room in terms of width, but it often means you can't see so well. So I will stay up here. I've got some questions for them. Trudy, do you mind if we start with you?
No, of course. Okay, great. Absolutely.
Okay, good.
We're chatting it up.
We're chatting it up. So what I would like to ask you is, so one of the points that I made today is about women as taking care of others, this pressure to please and be concerned about others' needs. And I know from talking with you that this is something you also observe in your work. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could say a bit about either your struggles or the struggles you see other people dealing with around for women taking care of others. And what strategies do you suggest to either work with that or move beyond it?
Well, first of all, let me just say, love your introduction.
Thank you.
You know, just to piggyback on Teresa's comments, you should know that your organizations are actually more profitable when you have women at more senior leadership levels. And so, you know, acknowledging the contribution of women, I think, is so important for all of us. Because, unfortunately, there are still some women who don't believe that women can be CEOs or president of countries. I'm just saying in a spirit of love. But, you know, I think a lot of us suffer, at least for me, the martyr syndrome, right? We've been socialized that you're supposed to walk in exhausted, right? And everybody's supposed to feel sorry for you. And then we get pissed off, quite frankly, when people don't feel sorry for us. Like, what's wrong? I've been slaving all day long. I mean, why don't you feel sorry for me, right? And so I certainly, you know, did that with my corporate career. And I'm recovering now. I'm in a much better stage of life. Because at the end of the day, you know, when you get on an airplane, you know, the instructions are you put on the mask for yourself first, right? You can't give anybody what you don't have. And actually, I think the research that I've done from my books indicate that women want to be collaborative, which is a great thing. Look, collaboration is one of the sexiest words alive right now in corporate America. And so you should be proud of yourself if you are collaborative, because people want to break down silos. They want to drive efficiency. They want to get to market faster. All those things are good. But any strength that we have can also become our Achilles heel. If we're not really careful, it can become our Achilles heel. And so one of the strategies that I started to deploy, a very practical strategy, is to make sure that the work in the home is divided, right? Like, orchestrate your home the same way you think about orchestrating your business. And it was actually Indra Nooyi. I don't know if we have any PepsiCo people in the audience today, but I was with Indra. She was a keynote presenter. I was on the same stage much later in the day, but she said something, and when I first heard it, I thought, wow, that doesn't sound right. She said one of her best pieces of career advice was to marry well. Mm. And I thought, well, women shouldn't have to marry well. I mean, you know, you should marry who you love. But then I started to really reflect on the backstory of what she was saying. And so for me, the way that I digested it was, marry a partner and ensure that the partnership allows for equal distribution of the work. And that same methodology, if you will, can be applied in the workplace. Because what women, what I've observed, and at one point I certainly did this, is that, you know, in my mind it was easier for me to do it because I knew what I was going to do, and I knew I would execute, right? I'd get that doggone thing done. But what I didn't appreciate and what I came to really have a passion around was the responsibility to develop other people. So that strategy works whether you're at home developing your future, the future leaders of this world, your children. They should have responsibilities when they're small, in my opinion. And so should that third, fourth, fifth baby known as your spouse or significant other. And so failing to recognize that you are a catalyst for making things happen versus making everything happen is a significant strategy that I'd like to depart as a takeaway for the audience.
Very nice.
Thank you.
So then I want to make sure everybody gets a chance to answer a question, then we'll kind of come back through. So Anne, I wanted to ask you, as someone who's dealing with so many issues in banking, right? Mm-hmm. I and as a vice president, I'm
CEO.
Guessing
senior vice president.
Senior vice president.
We'll make a CEO.
Thank
awesome.
You. Senior vice president.
Why not?
Those adjectives matter. You've earned that.
We were exactly. chuckling about it.
Thank you.
We can make you the CEO.
I don't know that we have that decision-making power. much power as we have here today. So as a senior vice president, thanks for correcting me. So Anne, can you... One of the challenges in a pressure that women often feel is to make sure everyone agrees, right? That can be a pressure that women feel. I'm wondering, plenty of male leaders can feel that as well. But I'm wondering, from your perspective, can you talk with us a bit about how you deal with active dissenters, people who are disagreeing with your decision and being very vocal about it?
Yeah. So. Thanks, Therese. It's sure. some good strategies that I've already heard on stage. It's awesome. But so with dissenters, I think the biggest thing in dealing with any decision and any strategy with decision is to have the foundation of what you're trying to achieve and the clarity of whether it's the high-level strategy, the high-level goal, the high-level outcome. Is everybody aligned around that? Mm-hmm. And if the dissenter may not be, that's where you start. Right. And to your point earlier about active listening and engaging, the dissenters are usually the most powerful voice in
That's
the
right.
room
That's right.
to providing impact to bettering whatever you're trying to decide. And I have learned over the years that engaging them, really working to understand and help them get past whatever their challenge is, has always, I would say almost 100% of the time, led to a much better outcome for the decision. So those dissenters, depending on how vocal they are, how polite they are, how respectful they are, some are harder to listen to than others, for sure. But working to understand their position and understand the foundation of their position. And at some point, if they clearly are not being practical, not being reasonable, or truly dissenting because they're not able to move with where you're trying to go, you have to cut bait, right? There's just, if anybody's read Who've Moved My Cheese, there's the mouse that just stays in place. And you have to give people a chance to move. But I believe working to understand those dissenters is sometimes the most powerful input you can get in the decision. The other clarity is, though, understanding what the parameters of the decision you're trying to make and how far out of bounds that dissenter might be trying to take you and the decision, and managing that as well, because you can spend a lot of time and waste a lot of time heading in directions that don't have anything to truly deal with the decision. So understanding the foundation of the decision, the guardrails of those decisions, and helping to bring the dissenter in to either add value and or move on.
Very nice. And do you, when you're trying to work with that dissenter, are you working with them in the room with everybody else present? Are you trying to do that, pull them aside? How do you make that judgment?
I mean, there's a couple different strategies there. Sure. So understanding the dissenters' influencers as well. So learning, typically it's not in the room, but finding out who their influencers are and really trying to bring that individual in to understand what the motivation and what their real agenda and advocacy is around their position. And again, just making a call as to whether that's a value add and worth the energy and or not. So it's a little bit in the room, but it's mostly outside of the room.
Okay, good. Very helpful.
Trying to get a safe place for them as well to express their position.
Exactly.
Sometimes it doesn't show up so well in the meeting. And to, again, kind of acknowledge that, take it out outside so that that individual has an opportunity to rationally present their position.
Yes.
As opposed to maybe emotionally.
Very nice. Thank you.
In the meeting, you know, you can actually set the person up for aligning and more success by saying, hey, I'm going to count on you to play devil's advocate.
That's right. Ask them to play the role.
Them to play the role. So rather than, you know, as a woman, be positioned as someone who's trying to belittle your power, you just call them out. You say, look, you know, apparently this is a passion for you. I'm gonna leverage that.
Right.
And you be my devil's advocate. And here's what I want from you. And then, you know, that helps to do
and
what you were saying.
Just to add, you know, Therese, to your point of understanding the room, really knowing the dissenter who may not be vocalizing their dissent, and spending a lot of time outside of the room activating the dissenters who could come against and really derail any kind of a decision or alignment around the decision. So I like that, calling them out afterwards to say, hey, I'm looking to you to be my devil's advocate in the room. And raise the issues because we're not hearing it and we're not moving in the right direction because of it. So.
And I would say I've seen where dissenters can at times become destructive, very publicly destructive, and there's a passive aggressiveness there. And what has worked for me, kind of similar to what you were talking about, is confronting it head on privately. But being very constructive in how you present it, not coming in and looking nervous, not, you know, coming in defensive, but just saying, here's the impact of your behavior on our team, on our objective, on the results that we're trying to deliver. You know, we can feel the way we want to feel, but at the end of the day, we have one objective, and that's to achieve this particular initiative or achieve this goal. So this is what I've experienced in the room. I just want to bring that forward and look for ways in which publicly we can show that we are working together and collaborating as one. And it was interesting, the very first time that I had done that, I was kind of in probably my first big new leadership position. I was in my late 30s, and I had that conversation with someone who was in his mid-50s. And I remember getting, kind of working up the courage to get in there and looked him straight in the eyes. And I just said, here's what I'm experiencing and here's the impact that it's having. And I remember this little voice in the back of my head thinking, I bet he's never had a 30-something come to him and tell him. But I was really pleasantly surprised to see how favorably he responded to very direct but constructive feedback. Mm-hmm. And there was a commitment to, I'm going to change. You're right. We have an objective. We need to come forward as a united front. And, you know, every opportunity I had post that discussion to try and reaffirm that commitment made things tremendously better.
He became one of the biggest advocates.
He became an incredibly good ally.
When you engage your devil's advocate, mm-hmm. again, because then they, through the process of that engagement, start to work to align.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because you've given them that permission and that respect,
that's right.
and
that's
they
right.
end up being your biggest advocate in a lot
that's
of
right.
cases.
Yep. That's right.
So I have a follow-up question now for Sonia. Again, she's a senior vice president for human resources at Phillips 66. So Sonia, what the research indicates is that for both men and women, a major factor in decision-making can be fear of regret, right? People are really anxious about, like, you know, they'll be inclined to stay with the status quo because if I do that, whom, you know, this awful thing might happen, or I might really regret it down the line. So if I may ask you, would you be willing to tell us about a decision that you've made in your career that looking back, have you regretted any of your career choices? And what have you learned from that experience in terms of how you thought about regret and how you navigated that?
So I fundamentally believe that we are the sum total of all of the decisions that we have made in our lives. Mm-hmm. So when I look back at all of these kind of turning points in my career, did I regret any of the decisions? Absolutely not. Did I make some good decisions? Yes. Did I make some bad decisions? Definitely. But what I found was that through the good decisions, I learned and I progressed, and through my bad decisions, I grew and I became stronger. So I don't regret any decision that I made because I do think that every single one of them got me to where I am today. But what's interesting is I'll share with you one decision. I was kind of reflecting on this last night. I was working at an industrial manufacturing company, and I was head of HR for what was called Rest of World, which was a really bad name for everything but the U.S. and Europe. And I reported into the CEO of Rest of World, and I had never met anybody in corporate. There wasn't a corporate head of HR. There wasn't a corporate CHRO. And the region operated rather independently from corporate. And about 6 months after I started, there was some really odd things going on. And I remember initially regretting that decision. I left a company that I loved to do something different, to kind of lean into a fear. And shortly thereafter, it turned out that there was a financial restatement in the Brazilian operation. So we all know that that is a really, really big deal for an organization. And I got a call from the general counsel on a Saturday. I was shopping at Best Buy. And I got a call from the general counsel, and he said, Sonia, we're going to need your help on Monday. And I didn't quite understand what he was going to do. Monday comes along. I get a call, and they said, we're going to be exiting the CEO. We need you to stand by his side. We need you to help gather his stuff, and we need you to walk him off the property. So I work in human resources. So unfortunately, the ugly part of my job is I do have to exit people from an organization. It's hands down the worst part of my job. But that was the first time I actually ever had to exit my boss. So he left. I walked him out that day. I get a call from the global CEO, and he says, I'm going to come down tomorrow. I want you to pull the team together, and we're going to figure out what we're going to do next. I was the only female on the team, a team of about 9 people. And all of them were coming to me saying, these are the things that we need to focus on. And all I could do is step back and think, but the root cause behind this financial restatement was culture, behaviors, leadership. Mm-hmm. And all of the other individuals on the team said, that's too fluffy, that's too soft, he's not going to want to talk about it. Sonia, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And I went home that night and I thought, do I follow my gut? Mm-hmm. Do I do what I think is right to do? The CEO comes in. It was the first time I'd ever met him face to face. We shook hands. We walked into a conference room. And he said, so what do you think, Sonia? And I had that decision. Mm-hmm. Do I follow the guidance of my colleagues who had been there for a long time? I was 6 months with the company. Or do I follow my gut on what I think is the root cause of why we got to where we were? And I followed my gut. And we spent 6 hours in the conference room that day. He wanted to deep dive on every single element of the culture and the people and the leadership that I had observed as kind of an external party, because I was new. That decision catapulted me to become the CHRO of that company. They had never had that position before. Mm-hmm. And because of that experience and then partnering with the CEO to manage the aftermath of a really, really difficult business situation, that's what allowed me to become my first CHRO. So there's a lot of really tough decisions that we're faced with a lot of times. But what I have found is I do follow my gut. I do what I think is right. Mm-hmm. If it's confronting the, you know, baby boomer about how destructive his behaviors are publicly, or telling the CEO who I've never met before what I think the root cause is. But it's having that courage to step forward and tackle those items that are hard to tackle.
And I have a please. Story of when I didn't follow my gut and ended up reversing the decision. So I'll be brief with it, but it was a career decision early on when I was in a company in Chicago, and I was CFO at the time and was given the opportunity to run a venture capital company, partner with the ex-CEO, and all of my colleagues, all of my advisors were saying, wow, this is a chance to make a lot of money. You'll have better work-life balance. My kids were young at the time. And, you know, why wouldn't you want to do this? This is right up your alley. You get to stay in Chicago. And my gut kept saying, but it's not really what I want. It's not the career track I want. But everybody was looking at me saying, gosh, you're coming home exhausted every day. This is, you know, you're putting all your energy into work and you have these young kids, and why wouldn't you do this? You can make so much more money. And so I chose to do what everybody else said, and my stomach was so upset on that decision. And then I talked to the CEO of the company I was with, and he just said, hey, look, I want you to think about this. I know you well enough that I'm not sure you're making the right decision. And he was so right. When I went back and really thought about the things I wanted for my career, the things I wanted for my family, the things I wanted in life, they didn't stack up. Mm-hmm. But I was doing what everybody else thought was right for me and on the outside looked like the absolute perfect decision. So the trust your gut.
That's right.
And know yourself.
That's right.
You know, I was
early
enough in my career too, I didn't have the confidence to know myself and to really stand on that gut. And I think it's a really powerful.
Mm-hmm. I actually think.
So I didn't go. I stayed.
And good for you that you were able to reverse it. I actually think that this is a muscle, a skill that women have that we haven't unearthed to our greatest potential. And I'll tell you that I think we need to own it. And let me tell you why. We operate in what's called a VUCA marketplace. And if you've never heard that terminology, it's volatile, it's uncertain, it's complex, and it's ambiguous. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have all the data. You're not going to have all the facts. In fact, the facts might not even have come into fruition, particularly in light of this fourth industrial revolution. And so we, as leaders, as female leaders, need to, as you said, trust yourself, but develop this muscle of seeing around the corner. Right? And it's something that we have to do a lot because we have been socialized, as the research says, you know, to care about everybody. We think about what's coming down the pike 2 days from now for the kids or next month or whatever. If you can take that same muscle and then apply it into the business world, you're going to show up as a thought leader. And showing up now as a thought leader is a clear path to success. Organizations need leaders who are confident and they can draw on their intuition to make decisions when there's not a safety net. Those safety nets, you guys, are gone because of the unpredictability of the marketplace. And so I think it's wise for all of us to step back and knowing ourselves, ask, do I trust my gut? Now to trust your gut, you have to read. You have to pay attention to what's happening in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. You paid attention to what was happening in that organization. You paid attention to what was happening within your body and your family and your values. And so I'm just taking this and applying it to a business perspective now. You've got to read like the Wall Street Journal on a daily basis, or you've got to read the Harvard Business mm-hmm. Review, or you got to read something so that you are resourceful. So the key to being able to make an intuitive decision is being resourceful. And that doesn't come unless you slow down. And I ask all of my clients, we need weekly white space with ourselves. We need an appointment with ourselves mm-hmm. to think. And if you're so busy running and doing for everybody else, you can't pull over. And so when the time does come for you to decide, can I go with my gut? The resources are not there. And so if you can practice building that, I think it will help you not only in your professional life, but also in your personal life.
Yeah, because you have to make quick decisions every day.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And this resource, I like that concept, because it's about understanding when you have to make a decision, you can't take the time to get all of the facts. So you have to have enough confidence in what information you need on a daily basis in the structure you're in.
That's right.
So that you can make quick calls.
That's
and that
right.
It does, for me at least, depend a lot on the trusted advisor, so who I'm speaking with and my knowledge of the particular issue, but gaining the resources in your business as well to be able to confidently make a decision quickly. It's not, you know, all of a sudden you have to stop, gather all the data, spend the time to make a decision.
You don't have it.
Can't.
You
just
don't have
can't.
It.
So you've got to have,
that deposit.
Resource that's yeah. broader.
So even doing things like reading The Economist, studying Futurist, you know, not to make this all about you guys going back and adding value to your organizations, but that's sort of why you're here, in a spirit of love. So, you know, it takes practice okay. to do this, and now's the time for you guys to build that muscle.
So I have one last question, then I'm going to turn it over to Jane. So my question is this. Some of you might be thinking, great, I have a strong intuition or an instinct about the particular decision, and that's going to work for me, and I'll go with it. But I don't know about you, but sometimes I don't have that strong gut feeling with some decisions. Instead, I make my pros and cons list, and I just like get to the third page, and I'm still making the list, and nothing's popping to the top as a priority, and I'm not feeling clarity, and it's just getting really murky. So do you have any strategies that you've read about or that you find useful so that you can cut through things when you're not sure and you don't have that gut intuition? What do you? How do you figure out the top priority?
So I'll start. My strategy is to leverage a network of professional friends who are outside of the world in which I live in the office, who can bring a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And it was only probably about 6 years ago-ish that I really saw the value of engaging with other career-oriented, you know, working moms who were in different professions than I was. So they were in legal and finance and procurement, supply chain, you name it. And we found that coming together, I mean, even Thursday night over a glass of wine and talking about some of the challenges that we are each faced with and some of the decisions that we had, they really helped me think through, you know, some of the nuts that I had a hard time cracking. You know, sometimes it's hard to find that safe place at the office, particularly when you're needing to make a very important decision. So having that safe place of outside of the office for me has always been tremendously beneficial.
Nice. And I think the magnitude of the decision mm-hmm. will drive the strategy and your methodology. So pros and cons lists are great, you know, if you're talking about which place to go on Friday night and whether you want music or not. When you're down to a list of very short, not impactful kinds of decisions. But I think with broader decisions, like when I made a career change from a company that I just loved and grew up in, knowing the impact was going to be significant because I would likely have to move my family, it took a year. And it was very methodical, and it was really understanding my guardrails. And I had 5 non-negotiables, and I had the choices that I was going to give up on. So frankly, when it came time to look at career opportunities, I knew which ones to just say no to. Don't even take the interview. And the one that I ended up going with, when I got down to, you know, check, 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 and the last one was a check and had to move my family to a city that I wasn't thrilled about. Leaving Chicago is really, really hard. But it was not even a question at that point. The risk had been de-risked in a way that it took a year. I hired a grad student to research companies. It was very methodical, but I knew the impact was going to be so significant that a pros and cons list would just frustrate me and cause all sorts of deliberations that weren't helpful to drive the decision.
And for me, you know, after I do what they've just said and have exhausted, you know, all the options of looking at it this way, looking at it that way, getting, you know, input, at the end of the day, I get quiet. I go by myself and I get really quiet and I pray. That my faith is a big part of who I am and how I show up. And if I don't feel that sense of peace, I just know it's not right. I just know it's not right. And I don't move until I feel a sense of peace, because I have to own that. You know, I love what you said at the beginning. I believe that we're all, you know, the summarization of all the choices that we've made in life. And so that, if we take it like that, right, I mean, that's serious. And so I don't want to make a decision lightly. I want to know that even if it's the wrong decision, that I did my due diligence. I was thoughtful. I didn't go into it lightly. I was mindful, and I was at peace to whatever degree that I could be.
Thank you, ladies. We have some time for questions, a few minutes. There are 2 microphones set up. If anybody would like to address the panelists or Therese, now's the time.
Hi, thank you so much. All of you were wonderful. A lot of things that we spoke about today, we were talking about decision making and how that decision kind of either was it right, was it wrong. But I feel a lot of times when a big decision is made, what follows after that is execution of it. And if it doesn't stay with you and you have to let go of it to another team or to another person, how do you manage that? How do you manage the execution part of it?
So I'll try and tackle that, because I had an experience where I was running the retirement plans business, and we had to create a huge strategy change, and had the foundation of the experience, or had the foundation of the strategy, had 3 key tenets that everybody from the top of operations down to the mailroom could recite. And then I was promoted into a different position in a totally different part of the business, and I felt very much like, wow, this is a massive shift of strategy for this business. My team is now at risk for all that we did. But it was that old adage of measure twice, cut once. We had done our work, and but frankly, it was the team was so excellent, and they were so engaged and passionate about and aligned around the strategy. I was able to let go, and the execution ended up happening, and I'm totally delighted that it really worked out. But I think that's there was a point of, I didn't need to be there for another year, but another 6 months would have given me a lot more confidence that the strategy was going to take hold. And in the end, I just had to trust that the people that I surrounded myself with were going to execute, and they did.
I'd like to add to that. Sorry, barely see you, but I would like to add to that. So one of the women that I interviewed from in a C-suite said that a strategy that she uses to make sure that the execution is going to go okay is that in the decision-making stage before the final word comes down is that she involves in the decision some of the people who are going to be key to execution.
Oh, yeah.
That's just standard.
That's standard.
It's standard.
Because they have to buy in.
They have to buy into it, right. And you're going to save a lot of time in execution to have those people be involved in the decision. And it's valuable to think that way because there can sometimes be the myth of the leader who's just decisive and, you know, the Steve Jobs who's just like, well, I know what's best for everybody. We're going to do this. But in terms of execution, you've got it. Having people, and also for millennials, that can they're expecting often to be involved in the decisions anyhow. So if you have a large team of millennials, it's a good strategy.
And that's a gap in what I said. Just to your point, there's no way that team would have been as passionate, aligned, if they weren't part of creating the strategy and owning it and feeling accountable to lead it through.
Good. And even if you create a strategy and you don't have the benefit of on the front side, including them, before you go to launch, you want to give it back to them and say, tear it apart.
Yeah.
Tear it apart. You know the process. Mm-hmm. You know operations better than me. Tear this thing apart. Tell me what's wrong. And now, you know, it's a partnership in the decision. And that's another way that you can get at their ownership and their buy-in.
Love the concept of the teardown session and getting commitment versus compliance. Very important.
Howdy, my name is Leslie Hassler. Thank you for coming here. I enjoyed every moment. I represent a lot of women entrepreneurs. And as women entrepreneurs, we don't always have staff. We don't always have a huge team behind. And you can be a business owner, but not be a leader. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of challenges, and what I see is a lot of abdication of hard decisions. And I love what you were talking about this concept of taking care of people. And I will say that Trudy kind of ticked into this a little bit, is we have that redefinition of what taking care of people mean. But there's still the weight of open loops, non-decisions that happen. For that person that might be by themselves or with one or two employees, what inspiration can you give them to actually start making decisions?
Well, I'm the entrepreneur on the stage, so I'll try and tackle that one. You got to pick the right people, okay? And I don't pick for skill. I pick for character. Because if I can't trust you, that I'm not going to want to give you the empowerment. And I've made the mistake. My husband, who is a right brain person more than I am, warned me about hiring a person, and I wasn't, you know, as peaceful, and I knew it. But in the moment, I just felt so much pressure because, you know, it was just an unfortunate situation. Her husband had passed away, and she wasn't there anymore. She wasn't there anymore, and it was a tough call. But I had to say to her, I think you need space. And I'm willing to pay you because I need your head and your heart. So when you get the head and the heart and you trust people, then you can say, okay, this is what I need you to do. But don't just toss it out there. Give them an opportunity to respond to this question. So walk me through your process. Tell me how you think you're going to get this done. What barriers do you think that you're going to run into? How are you going to overcome those barriers? Because I don't want you coming back to me, babe. Don't come back to me until it's done. And when it's done, I'm expecting that you have done your due diligence because I know you, I trust you, I value you. I tell my Karen, you know, she's from the UK, and so often she'll say to me, actually she's from South Africa, she'll say, so Trudy, are you listening? Because I'm not listening, okay? She's like, I'm going to do this, and I'm really not listening. So I think that the active listening that you talked about, but trust and just total empowerment comes with faith in that individual. But you've got the responsibility of teaching them, right? Get them up to speed. But then once they're up to speed, you got to fly, baby. I don't have time. And that's the way that it has to be as an entrepreneur.
Well, I think you have so many decisions as an entrepreneur, and they're at various levels. They're the really serious ones and then the day-to-day ones, and it's so easy. I know I do this. It's so easy to just want to make the quick ones And you end up spending most of your day doing that. So this, you know, taking the time and pausing and really understanding the most priority decisions that have to be made and how do you tackle them first. And I always reward myself with the little decisions so that I can feel good about it. I'm a list maker. Yeah, I love that. It's just like, it's my put things on to take them off just because. And, but I, you know, you can't, you have to really, with the limited time that I suspect you have and all of us have to make those priority decisions, just understand which decisions, it's not going to matter if they don't get made. But how do you force yourself to focus and make those big decisions, because mm-hmm. that's what takes the time, and a lot of time that's not what we want to do. It's really right. easy to bury yourself in email or whatever.
And make sure you have processes in place, because then that gives you a higher level of confidence, and it also gives your employees a higher level of confidence. There's a protocol, mm-hmm. and then that frees you up to make those mm-hmm. those tough decisions about strategy or, you know, business development or things like that.
Thank you, ladies. Let's give them a round of applause. Both Trudy and Therese will be available at the book signing in the exhibition hall within the next 10 minutes. Thank you for joining us, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Yeah. Oh, I follow my protector.